behalf of Appellant Andrew Hansen. Your Honor, my client's here today to ask for reversal of his express consent driver's license revocation on two grounds. One is that he was deprived of his right to cross-exam the officer that was subpoenaed. And then two is that his Fourth Amendment rights were violated when that officer entered into his residence. Your Honor, there's a threshold issue, and that is whether the exclusionary rule applies to DMV express consent hearings. If not, I would concede that I would lose on the Fourth Amendment argument. If so, then you must then determine whether or not there was an emergency aid exception under the facts, as the hearing officer seems to claim. Now, Your Honor, the exclusionary rule does apply for one of two reasons. Number one, pursuant to the established precedent, that's made application clear in Tipton v. Peterson. Alternatively, even under an AHARD analysis as to the application of the exclusionary rule in civil proceedings, it applies in that respect too, because it's interest sovereign and it is indeed quasi-criminal. I'm going to get to that in a minute. I'm not going to discuss entry into the home unless you have questions about it. It's clear from the record, and there's plenty of facts in the record that do not support the emergency aid, and then this morphed into a consensual encounter once the officer's in the home. Instead, I want to touch on kind of the legal issues, start with cross-examination, then talk about the exclusionary rule. You know, it's clear that the respondent has a right, even in administrative hearings, to cross-examination. The question before you is whether that right was deprived in this instance. The hearing officer found, well, let me back up. Once the police officer was subpoenaed and failed to appear, a motion was made to dismiss the action. And the hearing officer responded that it's unnecessary because he agreed. There was no warrant and there were no exigent circumstances allowing for the officer to enter the home. The hearing officer then issued an order that said, oh, it's emergency aid exception. So that reasoning ignores the fact that emergency aid and as well as consensual encounter are fertile grounds for cross-examination. Now, obviously, if you do not feel that the exclusionary rule applies to express consent hearings, then the right to cross-examination on those topics would be irrelevant. However, there are obviously other reasons for cross-examination at a DMV hearing, include whether the client admitted that he was driving, identification of the client, whether he drank alcohol after he got home, things like that. And the DMV was aware of this. On page 62 of the record, you'll see that when requesting to subpoena the officer, these issues were raised, and the DMV was told, we want to cross the officer on identification and things like that, not just the Fourth Amendment.
Counsel, was the hearing officer ever offered or was it suggested that he take an intermediate approach, which was instead of dismissal and instead of depriving your client of his right to cross-examine, did anybody ask for a continuance or suggest that a continuance would cure any potential prejudice to him?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe at the hearing anyone requested a continuance, but looking back at the record, there's good reason for it. On August 17th is the date of offense. Under statute, the DMV loses jurisdiction at 60 days. This is October 14th, so it would be the 58th day. So I think there was really only one remedy that probably could have been effected.
Is there any offer of proof made as to what the officer would have testified if he had been there?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Is there a requirement that such an offer of proof be made?
I'm not aware of one. So whether the Fourth Amendment or whether the exclusionary rule applies or not, you know, there are other bases to cross-examine an officer at a hearing. And so under either scenario, my client was denied or deprived that right to cross-exam. And for that reason alone, the revocation should be reversed. Moving to the exclusionary rule, though, and the whole Fourth Amendment issue, it's my position we don't need to go through the AHARD or U.S. v. Janus analysis. That's because the express consent statute, 42.4.1301.1, injects into that system the probable cause requirement. And by doing so, it injects the Fourth Amendment. And that's essentially what Tipton v. Peterson said. When Tipton v. Peterson said that you can challenge the basis for the stop and the subsequent arrest. I mean, if those are relevant to be challenged, then that's the relevance of the exclusionary rule. So
you're saying that the fruit of the poisonous tree, if it's applicable, vitiates probable cause and doesn't just require the suppression of, say, evidence?
No, I'm saying that because probable cause is in the statute by the legislature, then that injects the Fourth Amendment and the exclusionary rule into the process.
So you may not know the answer to that, but is that how it works in a 18 U.S.C. 1983 case?
I don't know the answer, but if the question, if where the court is going is whether or not the exclusionary rule applies to civil proceedings, I'd like to touch on that a little bit.
I guess my question is, just referencing probable cause in a civil statute, I'm not sure why your position is that that brings in all of the Fourth Amendment, including the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine.
It would seem to me that, it would be irrelevant to have, for Peterson to have said and interpreted that because probable cause is in there, you can challenge the initial stop. That would only be relevant if the exclusionary rule applies, in my mind. But looking at Ahart and U.S. v. Janus and the application of the exclusionary rule to civil proceedings, if you look back in Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, there was a time when the federal law enforcement would violate the Fourth Amendment but were bound by the Constitution, but could give that information to the state. It was called the silver platter doctrine, on the silver platter for the state prosecutors to then use it, because the Fourth Amendment at that time didn't apply to the states.
What would have been excluded if the rule were to apply here? What evidence would have been excluded that came in, that couldn't have come in some other way?
All of the evidence after he entered the house. So the contact with my client, the ID, the fact that he smelled intoxicated, had some indicia of intoxication, all of that evidence. Refusal, I guess essentially the fact that he refused to test. So the question is, in this scenario, can the law enforcement officer essentially violate the Fourth Amendment, assuming that's so in this case, and then give it to the DMV on a silver platter? Now, the Ahart and U.S. v. Janus have suggested a two-part inquiry into whether or not exclusionary rule applies to civil proceedings. The first part is the deterrent effect. And in determining the deterrent effect of the exclusionary rule on the officer in this scenario, they look at whether the violation was intra-sovereign versus inter-sovereign. In this case, it was certainly intra-sovereign, and that's because the officer is acting as a statutory agent for the DMV. It's not as black and white as kind of who pays the paycheck, right? The Douglas County Sheriff's Office, the DMV, they seem like two separate agencies. But in this scenario, U.S. v. Janus said the question is whether the officer has a responsibility or duty to or agreement with the sovereign seeking to use the evidence. That's page 455 of U.S. v. Janus. In the statute 424.1301.1, the law enforcement officer investigating the DUI has the duty and responsibility to the DMV. They have the duty to give the express consent advisement. They have the duty to take the license, the duty to issue a DMV form to the defendant, the express consent affidavit. So in all respects, they are acting as a statutory agent for the DMV, enforcing the DMV's rules and regulations. The second prong or part of the test is whether or not it's quasi-criminal. In determining whether or not the proceeding is quasi-criminal, Justice Stewart, in his dissent in U.S. v. Janus, commented, the difference between criminal and civil case is irrelevant for exclusionary rule purposes where the civil proceeding serves as an adjunct to the enforcement of criminal law. He then gave an example, forfeiture proceedings. The Ahart case also used that example, forfeiture for proceedings. So I would submit to the court as an express consent proceeding anything other than a forfeiture proceeding. It's essentially a proceeding to forfeit one's license.
Isn't that because of public safety considerations?
The forfeiture of the license?
Yeah.
Yes, that is one of, under 422.126, one of the purposes of the statute.
The forfeiture of property in a related to a criminal case, is that for some, what purpose would that be for?
So that the property you're forfeiting could not then again be used in a criminal violation. So in that respect, I think the analogy holds up, because the purpose behind the driver's license and express consent is to take away that non-contraband, you know, the driver's license, so that it cannot then be used again in a criminal proceeding. But essentially, the adjunct nature of the two is what the USVJ court said that we should look at. And if you look at 42.4.1301, right next door at 42.4.1301.1 is the express consent springing from the same statute, sending, you know, it's the legislative directive to both the police and the DMV, and they work in concert in that regard. To put it another way, an express consent revocation can arise in no other circumstance other than in a criminal investigation. So they are inextricably linked, which is different from, say, the Hoffman case, where the attorney was prosecuted criminally for narcotics. That case was later thrown out for a Fourth Amendment violation, but the Office of Attorney Regulation said, no, we can still use it because there's no link between the officers investigating. They're not doing it on our behalf or anything like that. It's different in this case, where they spring from the same statute. So on that basis, Your Honors, I'd ask that you do reverse the revocation on those grounds, and I'll save the remaining 3.5 minutes.
I have one quick question you. Do we have any guidance in the statute itself or otherwise that the probable cause language in both 1301 and then in 126 means something other than what it means in a traditional criminal case?
No, Your Honor, we don't. And I think that we can, when the legislature uses that language, I think it's safe to assume that they use it with that purpose and with that definition.
Aren't there plenty of civil statutes, though, that use the term probable cause just to refer to a quantity of evidence and not necessarily the Fourth Amendment?
Well, yes, but at the same time, I think that quantity of evidence is because we want to protect citizens from unreasonable search and seizure, and therefore want to require that there is a certain amount before the officer can move forward. I think that's the very essence of probable cause. But there are other considerations as to, it's not just the fact that it says probable cause. That's not the only hook to hang the hat on in this case. It's also intra-sovereign. It's also quasi-criminal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. My name is Grant Sullivan, Assistant Attorney General, representing the Colorado Department of Revenue Motor Vehicle Division. Your Honors, this court should affirm the hearing officer's decision revoking Mr. Hansen's driver's license for two main reasons. First, applying the Colorado Supreme Court's Ahart decision, the Fourth Amendment's exclusionary rule does not apply in a civil driver's license revocation proceeding. Second, Your Honors, even if this court does conclude that the rule should apply, or if it decides that it need not reach that issue, affirmance is still appropriate because the hearing officer correctly denied Mr. Hansen's motion to dismiss based on the deputy's absence. Before turning to Ahart, I did want to address a question that you had, Judge Boris. You asked, is there any requirement about an offer of proof when a witness under subpoena does not appear? And there is such a requirement. It's in the department's regulations dealing with witnesses under subpoena, and it's Rule 5.10.3. Turning to Ahart and the Fourth Amendment, Ahart, of course, requires a weighing of the deterrent benefits of applying the exclusionary rule against the societal costs of excluding relevant evidence. And as counsel correctly pointed out, it involves a two-part test. First, was the action intra or inter-sovereign? And second, is the proceeding quasi-criminal in nature? On the first part, Your Honors, this action is inter-sovereign in nature. None of the peace officers here involved are agents or employees of the Colorado Department of Revenue. Deputy Ashby is a Douglas County Sheriff's Deputy. Trooper Greasley is a Colorado State Patrolman, as is Trooper Sajik, also Colorado State Patrol. None of them are employees or agents of the Colorado Department of Revenue. In this context, the only published decision I know that actually applies Ahart in the context of a civil driver's license revocation proceeding is Judge Furman's special concurrence in the Baldwin case. And he likewise concludes that peace officers in this context are not agents or employees of the Colorado Department of Revenue, concludes it's inter-sovereign in nature. On the second prong of the Ahart test, Your Honors, is the proceeding quasi-criminal in nature? If it's quasi-criminal in nature, the purpose of it, of course, is to impose punishment. And I think, Judge Boris, it was you who correctly pointed out that here the purpose is not to impose punishment. It's simply to ensure the safety of the public roadways and to remove the privilege of driving someone who's been determined dangerous, poses danger to other persons using the public highways. We have some statutory language that says that driving is not a right, it's a privilege. And so rather than imposing punishment, it is a safety device in the revocation context.
Also, but hasn't the legislature also told us that part of having this whole administrative determination and administrative proceeding includes guarding against the potential for an erroneous deprivation of the driving privilege by providing an opportunity for a full hearing? In conjunction with that, you know, the regulations provide that folks like Mr. Hansen can subpoena a witness and have a right to cross-examine. So putting those two together, why shouldn't we conclude that he was deprived of his opportunity to have a full hearing because he didn't have access to the officer and, you know, to questioning the circumstances?
Of course. Your Honor, there are some specific regulations that the department has enacted to deal with these hearings. They're fairly detailed, and they're to ensure that the drivers afforded due process in these hearings. The regulation I quoted earlier states that if a witness is under subpoena and fails to appear, if the witness is not the officer signing the affidavit and notice of revocation, then, and he fails to appear, being under subpoena, an offer of proof must be made regarding the relevance and the content of the evidence. In this case, counsel merely stated that he wanted to know the circumstances surrounding, the details surrounding Deputy Ashby's entrance into the home. There was no offer made as to why this wouldn't be cumulative of the written report of Deputy Ashby that was already in the record. In fact, the two witnesses that counsel brought with him in support of the driver stated that their testimony corroborates the written report of Deputy Ashby. I also point you, Judge Fox, to this court's Fallon decision. In Fallon, the driver wished to subpoena an officer who allegedly witnessed the roadside test but did not perform the roadside tests. The department refused the subpoena, and on appeal, Chief Judge Davidson said that was okay because there was sufficient record evidence, wholly apart from the roadside tests, that supported probable cause. Here, I think the same thing can be said. There is sufficient record evidence in the record demonstrating probable cause wholly apart from anything surrounding the entrance into the residence. You have the ready reporter, Mr. Shields, saying a car just went by me going 100 miles per hour. It was swerving. It almost rolled. It swerved to make an exit, and in doing so struck a 6x6 highway sign. I was so overcome by this, I felt compelled to follow the driver to the residence, met Deputy Ashby at the residence. Viewed the damaged vehicle in the garage, and no responses were made to his announcements. That, taking that all together, is sufficient, wholly apart from any evidence surrounding the entry into the residence, to support the probable cause in this case.
Mr. Sullivan, that's all well and good for reckless driving, but how would you know that the person was intoxicated until they appeared and had alcohol smelling breath and bloodshot eyes and that sort of thing?
I'd have to check the record, Judge Boris, but I think that the ready reporter mentioned that it was a drunk driver. I mean, the ready acronym is report every incidence of drunk driving. So I think Deputy Ashby took that as being, this is a reporter, of a ready reporter reporting an incident of drunk driving. The evidence of weaving, the truck almost rolled, it was going 100 miles per hour. Also the evidence of the damaged windshield, the damaged roof of the vehicle. There was evidence of a flashing light in the garage coming from the truck. I don't know if it was a blinker still on after it was parked in the garage, what it might have been, but all that evidence taken together, I think, is sufficient to establish probable cause for the revocation.
Mr. Sullivan, you mentioned that You had two grounds. One was that the court correctly denied the motion to dismiss based on the absence of a witness. Is that a wholly separate ground that allows us to affirm the decision, or is that just an ancillary issue?
I did want to go back and spend some time on the exclusionary rule, Your Honor. That was the first point.
All right. Well, but I just want to make sure. Are you saying that just because the witness was dismissed, that's a ground that we can affirm on?
I certainly think
The dismissal was not granted. I'm sorry.
Right.
Based on the absence.
Dismissal is proper both because the offer of proof was insufficient, and I think this court can follow Fallon on a completely sufficient and independently sufficient grounds.
I'm also having trouble understanding how somebody can make an offer of proof about cross-examination that's more specific than what counsel did here. If it's your own witness, I mean, you can sort of say, I know this witness will say exactly this. When you're doing a cross-examination, you can say what you expect the witness might answer, but...
It is more difficult. I would point, Your Honor, to the Nye case, I think, is a good example. In that case, the subject of cross-examination, there was evidence of someone having whited out the results of the chemical test and writing something over that. I think that's fertile ground for cross-examination. Here, there was nothing that he didn't offer anything that he wanted to question him on, anything inconsistent in his report. In fact, he said that his two witnesses corroborated what was in the written report. So I think you have to come up with something more than just, well, I'm going to ask him some questions. He didn't do that in this case. Under Fallon, I think that that's just simply insufficient under the department's regulations. More is needed. I did want to spend some time on Ahart and the Fourth Amendment. Excuse me, Your Honor. On the quasi-criminal point, counsel talks about the forfeiture proceedings. That is a proceeding where the purpose is to impose punishment. You can't keep the getaway car from a bank robbery. It's to extract property use in the commission of a criminal offense. The purpose of that is to impose punishment. That's just not the case here. The purpose here is to ensure the safety of public highways. We have Ahart, which talks about deportation proceedings are not quasi-criminal in nature. You have the AEL case from this court saying dependency neglect cases are not quasi-criminal in nature. If the prospect of being forcibly removed from this country, the prospect of having your children forcibly removed from you are not quasi-criminal in nature, certainly a civil driver's license revocation proceeding is not quasi-criminal in nature. On the weighing of the societal costs of applying the exclusionary rule and do they outweigh its deterrent benefits, again, I would point the court to Judge Furman's special concurrence in Baldwin. I don't think I can improve upon it. I think it hits it right on the head. He says individuals driving under the influence of alcohol pose great danger to the public, and restrictions on the state's ability to remove such individuals from its highways carry great cost to society. Before leaving the Fourth Amendment, Your Honors, I just wanted to stress the importance of this issue. If you read the dialogue between counsel and the hearing officer, if you read the hearing officer's written order, it's clear that they are struggling. They are striving for guidance on this exact issue. Hearing officers are employing Fourth Amendment analyses when they don't necessarily need to. We don't have a majority opinion in this state applying Ahart to a civil driver's license revocation proceeding. I think that's something that is needed in this state. It's also having the effect of producing some needless litigation on this very topic because we don't have a majority opinion that's published on this issue. Just 2 weeks ago, my colleague was in this courtroom arguing this identical issue before a different panel of this court. I think it's going to continue arising. It's going to be continued to be argued below until we have a majority decision definitively resolving Ahart in this context. For all these reasons, Your Honor, we'd ask that you affirm the hearing officer's revocation decision.
Thank you. Edel?
Just a few points I want to cover briefly. Number one, as to the inter-sovereign, intra-inter-sovereign. Counsel pointed out that they work for two different agencies. And again, this is what I was speaking to. It's not a black and white analysis as to where the paycheck comes from. Janus, in the case law, it says that you have to look a little bit deeper. You have to dig a little deeper. And if you read Janus, you'll see it says the question is not black and white. It's do they have a duty? Do they have a responsibility to this other agency that seeks to use the evidence? And that duty is not in dispute. The police officers clearly have a duty to the DMV to investigate license revocation issues, and that's in the 1301.1. Number two, on the offer of proof issue, Judge Terry, your point is well taken. You articulated it better than I could, but that's exactly it. What we wanted to cross the officer on was his entry into the home, and then the other matters, the ID and that sort of thing, and that's in the record. But in his report did say I entered the home. So simply because the witnesses were consistent with that doesn't mean that it's not good grounds for cross. Everyone is saying, yeah, you entered the home. We want to know why. What's interesting, too, about that is the response was, I agree with you. There was no warrant, and there were no exigent circumstances. So the hearing moved on from that. But then we get an order, and it says emergency aid exception. So when you talk about a full and fair hearing, that kind of calls that into question a little bit. And then finally, Your Honor, it's the quasi-criminal nature of the point. I want to just reiterate, you cannot separate the two. You cannot separate an express consent revocation proceeding from a criminal investigation. They always are together. There's never one without the other. And that's different from the attorney regulation in Harfman, or the INS case, or the dependency and neglect case. Those situations can arise absent a criminal investigation.
They're not tried together, though, right, counsel? One's a separate criminal proceeding and one's a separate civil proceeding.
They're separate only where and when they occur. But the evidence is this. I'm sorry.
Is there any res judicata or collateral estoppel effect between the two proceedings?
Not that I'm aware of. But as far as the purpose not being punishment but safety in the highways, the purpose is also, and that's at 42.4.126, subpart B says, the purpose also includes opportunity for a full and fair hearing. And so kind of looking at the overall public policy point, what we have here is an officer who walks into a home, and then we have an officer, he then ignores a subpoena. And no one gets to ask him any questions about it and explore that at all. So when you're looking at Mr. Hansen's chance for a full hearing, it's certainly the facts and the law seem to suggest that it was deprived on a number of bases, either cross-examination or exclusionary rule in the Fourth Amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank both counsel for your fine arguments. The case is deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.